Hello and welcome to the Bosun's Call Woodworking Podcast, Episode 6. I'm your host, James the Bosun, and today we have for you, guest in front of the show, my wife, Esther.
Yeah!
Today we'll have for you a beer tasting of a green tea IPA, which I have personally never tried that particular type. We have a cool tool for you, a pirate slash sailor term, and today we're talking about woodworking mistakes, making them and fixing them. And we're also going to give you a top 10 list of my beginner's projects for you. Simple things that'll teach you a lot of good basic woodworking skills. Without further ado, let's get cracking. Hi, Esther.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Doing quite well.
What do you have over there?
So today we have a Brewing Project Gunpowder IPA.
I like it already.
It has a lovely, sad little skeleton hiding behind exploding barrels on a ship, so appropriate to the theme of the podcast. It's an India pale ale with citrus, centennial, and gunpowder green tea. So it's the smoky.
I have no idea. I hope it's explosive.
Well, I know the green tea has a smoky taste to it. So
Okay.
All right.
Let's go. All right. You know what I love about IPAs from small breweries is they do not skimp. That, yet again, was full right to the brim.
Yeah, I think I'm going to overfill the glass.
That's very clear. I don't know what I expected. I expected it to be green. I think immediately out of the can.
It might have a slightly greenish tinge to it, but...
Oh, it does have some haze to it. I thought it was clearer. It's kind of mixing and settling.
Interesting. All right, here goes.
I can kind of smell maybe some green tea on it. Mmm.
You have a mustache.
Yes, I do.
Foam situation.
I also have foam in my mustache. That's good. I mean, I can kind of taste. I don't know if you gave it to me, if I would immediately say, like, that's green tea.
No, but it does have a little bit of a light floral.
Mm-hmm. I've definitely had IPAs that have a very grassy kind of taste to them. That's kind of what I would like describe this one as if I didn't know it was green tea right off the bat. But it's a hazy-ish kind of IPA because it's you can't see straight through it, so it's not super clear. That is very tasty though.
It is drinkable.
Still very smooth finish. I would say it's definitely more floral, more kind of grassy.
Doesn't taste like floor cleaner.
No, it does not. Yeah, I'd go back to that. I didn't know what to expect with the green tea thing. I didn't know how heavy it was going to be on the green tea. Like, I've had green tea confections and things like that, and it's kind of very forward, the green tea.
Yeah, especially if you use matcha. I don't like matcha.
I think that's what I was expecting, was mm-hmm. matcha. Now that you say that, that makes more sense to me. But you were about to pick this up, and I ended up picking it up independent.
So it was meant to be.
Yeah, because it says gunpowder on it, it has skeletons and barrels of gunpowder, like, obviously.
It's perfect for a pirate woodworking podcast.
Wow. I mean, what a coincidence. We're actually on a pirate woodworking podcast.
So strange.
All right. So what is our cool tool today? We have, actually, you picked this one up.
Because I did. I like it.
You enjoy this. So this is you can find this at Rockler and lots of other different places. It is a spring-loaded nail set.
I like it because I don't generally get nails into projects completely straight.
or completely below the surface.
Yes.
We're talking specifically about like brad nails, typically, or finishing nails. So what this is designed to do is to drive them into or further into, let's say if you're going to do sanding and stuff, you don't want to be sanding the top of a nail, you can set or drive further in the nail. You can get a spring-loaded nail set on Rockler that includes a variety of a couple different things, a couple different sizes. So what I'm looking at here is it's got two, it looks like, machined metal pieces that are joined by a pretty heavy-duty spring. The whole thing is about the size of a pencil.
And they look like pencil ends.
They look like pencil ends, but they each have like a divot in the steel end. And what you do is you put the top of the nail in that divot, pull the spring back, and you'll notice, like, on the insides, there's two little, like, what would you describe those as? They're like cylinders that strike against each other. So either way you do it, and like if you hold the set end that you're going to use, pull the other one back and snap it, it will drive that nail in. I love it because you don't have to break out a hammer to mm-hmm. use it. Although you could just get, you know, a regular set, but it's kind of cool because it's a cool tool. So it's cool because you don't have to get anything else and it has two sizes. I use this all the time when I'm driving brad nails because inevitably you're working at a weird angle or something. You don't just get the downward pressure when you're driving the nail mm-hmm. and it doesn't go all the way in, or it just hits a harder spot in the wood and doesn't go all the way in. And you can just use this to drive those into your desired depth so you're not running into them. No more hammer marks either, yeah, because you can actually set it, even if you're just trying to drive a nail head deeper into the wood because mm-hmm. you're going to be planing or sanding afterwards and you don't want that to be an issue, you can just drive them deeper in and it doesn't mar the surface anymore and you can fill them afterwards and they disappear.
It's brilliant.
Yes. All right, so let's talk about our pirate sailor term. Oh, so I should say, speaking of fixing mistakes, last time we did four sheets of the wind. It's not four sheets of the wind. It's three sheets of the wind, which still is, you know, you have a couple of ropes, you know, three ropes that are attached to the edges of your sails that give you control over the sails in which direction you're going that are loose. So, you know, you're already kind of awash, you know, and adrift uncontrollably. But anyway, like, four sheets of the wind, really bad. But the normal saying is three sheets of the wind. I already had a listener reach out to me and be like, that's wrong. So, but maybe I did it on purpose just to get some engagement, you know? So feel free to call me out on my mishaps because, you know, we're all human. It happens.
That's how you learn and move forward.
Yeah. You don't learn from your successes. Well, maybe a little bit, but not as much from your mistakes. All right, so today's sailor term, or pirate's term, because they both would have used it, is full sail. So full sail meaning full assault, you know, full tilt. You're going after it. It's with all the sails set, a ship moving full ahead or moving ahead full sail, rapidly, forcefully. So, you know, you're like, the world is coming at me today. Like, work has hit me like full sail today. All in, you know. Kind of how it's used today, but that's where it came from. Is it was like full sail, your sails are full of wind, you're going at something as hard as you can, and then that actually, after the sails gave way to the engine, it became all ahead full. But the full is your sails full of wind, so it means full assault, all ahead full. We're all in, you know. they all coincide, it all works together. But full sail, I caught myself actually using this the other day, like. In that context, too, like, mm-hmm. hey, man, like I missed some small thing, kind of slipped through the cracks, and I'm like, I don't know what to tell you. Life's been coming at me full sail, so you know, and I'm like, ooh, good one, you know.
I
use stuff I don't even know that I use. Like, I think I had a freebie. I got a listener told me that I had a freebie that I threw out there and didn't even realize I was using because I use a ton of sailor terms all the time, every day.
They have permeated our culture.
Yeah, well, and that's what I love about. Going back and finding the derivations of these sayings is that we use them all the time, but we don't realize that we're using them. Mm-mm. And it's kind of cool. And I think it's fascinating to go back and look at where they came from and how they evolved. Because some of them change over time.
Yes.
You know, the other one was about the devil in deep blue sea. It was actually my mother who was telling me, be like, oh, you forgot the last part of that. I'm like, oh, do tell. And she's like, having the devil pay and no hot pitch is having a hard job to do and not the right tools to do it. So that's yet another evolution of a saying mm-hmm. that probably less used. But if you're into reading this kind of genre of book, I'm sure you've come across it because a lot of these are from like Treasure Island and, you know, a lot of other kind of literary tales, which are, you know, they were written in a time closer to when these terms were actually used. Yes. So they're probably, you know, probably still well in use. So anyway, enough about me rambling on about that. Or what is our first topic?
Mistakes. Dents, scratches. So I know that mistakes have been made in the shop.
Oh.
I don't know about all of them. You haven't told me about all of them.
You never will.
I know that sometimes I get called out to the shop to see if I can spot where the fixed mistake is.
Oh, yes, yes. That's always fun to see if you can see.
I'm the second pair of eyes. It's like, okay, can she find it?
Well, and we're always very, like, as we're woodworkers, we're always very self-critical about our projects. And we know where all the faults are. But we don't necessarily, like, we think that anyone else is going to see them plain as day. But oftentimes, we're the only ones that see the small mistakes. But when it comes to mistakes that are big enough that you do need to fix, yeah, definitely. It's handy to have, like, can you see where this is? And if I have to point it out to you, I know it's okay. I did a good enough job fixing it or covering it up.
Lots of covering it up.
Oh, yeah. No, a woodworker is not measured by the successes, but how well he covers up his mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what's the first one you have for me?
I have dents.
Dents.
Probably related to scratches.
Dents are different. Dents are impressions in a wood surface that do not actually break the surface wood fibers.
Okay.
And you may not believe me, but you're actually going to break out a clothes iron. Yes, like ironing clothes to fix this problem. So don't slap the iron on the wood like hot. Like, you'll get a very interesting pattern. But what you can do for dents, as long as they haven't broken the surface fibers and it's just, you know, a dent, that's it. As long as it's not too deep, even some what look like scratches, you may look at them closer and they're just an indentation that's, you know, along it.
Well,
from
I imagine
something.
If it was very superficial also, you could raise it and then sand over it again.
Maybe. But if it's just a dent, what you'll do is you'll want to get a damp rag, put it over the surface, put the iron on it, full steam ahead, just like full sail. And and like give it some heat and some moisture. What that's going to do is, because the wood fibers are still plant cells, they're going to absorb some of that moisture and it will raise that dent back up. It'll restore it for the most part. Just like sometimes when you're sanding, if you're trying to get a really smooth finish, you can give the surface some water, spritz it with some water. Mm-hmm. It'll raise the grain fibers, and then you can sand over the top of that, and it'll get basically all the high spots off.
Extra smooth.
And that's how you can fix dents. It actually works surprisingly well.
Interesting.
Yeah, but just don't lay the iron straight on the wood.
That's fair.
Yeah, so that's pretty much dents. If they're super, super deep, you might have to, if you have some room to sand, you can also sand to get rid of, you know, some of the, essentially the raised stuff around it to kind of normalize everything around it so it's all the same and it will disappear.
Gotcha. What about scratches?
Scratches are a bit harder because scratches, I'm assuming, are more than dents. They are actually breaking wood fibers as they mm-hmm. go along. So scratches, it depends. If it's on a finished surface, you could maybe sand down the finish and then apply more finish. And that may, because that's really where you notice them, is in, because then it turns like almost a white color, especially in something like a polyurethane or something like that. Because
yeah.
it's actually just, you're just scratching the clear coat, essentially.
It's a scar.
Yeah, so you'll notice that more. If it's into the wood fibers, there's not much you're going to do about that other than maybe sand it out.
Gotcha.
If it's really deep scratches, you may do a patch where you'll, you know, break out a router template and you'll route out a certain amount of it and then get some of the same species, hopefully in a similar grain direction, and pattern, and then make a patch.
You got to have all of those little wood scraps lying around.
Oh,
don't
yeah.
throw those
save,
out.
Save them all. Like
save all the sawdust.
Yes, the sawdust too. Like, you're going to be a terrible hoarder after this episode. You're like, no, I have to save everything. There's a reason for all of my madness. Yeah, scratches are harder. Typically, some sanding and some refinishing will help with that, but it just depends on how deep the scratches are, right? And a lot of those are from pets, typically, and they're difficult to get out.
Silly pets. Gotta love them. They're so cute. What do you do when you cut past your line? What does that mean?
Well, you can do this with either your power tools or with your hand tools, and that's whatever line you decided you were going to stop at, you don't stop at. So there's a couple, it depends on what it is, right? And you can, and this answer could be as varied as a clamping solution. It could be, you know, 100 different things. It just depends on where it is. So like routing past your line, you're going to have, you know, a roundish shape past your line. Tough to patch that. But again, you're going to want to find, you're going to keep your scraps. You're going to use those. You're going to find a similar looking piece of wood, similar grain. You're going to orient the grain direction, hopefully. Like, that's the next level of patching, right? Is if you're getting similar wood color, grain direction, you're paying attention to all those things when you lay it in, has the greatest chance of just blending in with everything and disappearing. I mean, you could go so far as to get a paint pen and actually draw. I've seen people draw in the wood grain.
Oh, no, I saw that job. It looked really good.
Yeah, to make it disappear. And it looks fantastic, you know, because
I had to have the injury pointed out to me.
Yeah. So it totally works. If you have, you know, some artistic talent, you could do that. But you might, it might be easier to do a square patch. So you might actually, you know, scribe some lines and then maybe cut out with a chisel a square patch for that and then replace it. Cutting past your lines, sometimes if it's like with a handsaw, that's going to have a really, really thin kerf. That is the amount of material width that your saw removes, however wide your saw blade is. You can sometimes, like with handsaws, just patch that with wood glue, and this is where the sawdust that you're hoarding comes in. If you have sawdust from the same wood species, it's going to be a good color match. Mm-hmm. So you can mix that in with some wood glue, and there's lots of different kinds, right? So like Tight Bond 2 is a lighter wood glue, so if you have a more kind of blonde wood, you could use that mixed with some of the sawdust that you got from some sanding, you know, empty out your little filter catch bag from your sander, and mix that in with the glue, and then use the glue to patch that little, you know, overshot on your saw, and that will blend in very nicely. Also, there are plenty of different fillers. That trick will also help the patch accept a stain if you're doing stain afterwards.
Yeah, that wouldn't be as much of a line.
There's not as much of a line. You're still going to see it because the glue will not receive the stain as much. So what you can do is, after you put the glue in there, sprinkle on some sawdust and press it in, so you get more wood on the surface of that of the glue patch type of thing. So if you just go over a little bit, you can do that. If you really mess up, you're talking about more like kind of like hogging out a square patch and then figuring out.
You just embrace it and make it part of the pattern.
Yeah, you could be like, yeah, I just wanted to cut further along anyway.
Absolutely. Type of thing. Make it a little smaller. It's fine.
You know, and then for major mistakes, sometimes, yeah, you just have to start over, especially if you haven't glued in anything already and you're having to fix it after the fact. Like, if you just cut a board too short, like, go get another board. Yeah. You can say, put that in the scrap bin. It'll come in handy later. It just depends on what your problem is. And no two problems are alike, so you just have to get creative with it. But those are a couple of things that will help you when you overshoot your layout lines.
Mm-hmm. What about sanding burn through?
Oh, burn through. It's a bigger problem with plywood, because that outer veneer layer on plywood, because often like there's less, the lower quality woods in the core of it, and then the outside is the pretty stuff. So if you get like oak plywood, is a very, very thin veneer. You're kind of screwed when you burn through that. Again, you could cut out, you know, a very specific patch and then put in a different piece. You know, you could also do the trick with, if you're artistically talented, drawing in some of the wood grain pattern and stuff like that.
I mean, it's oak. It's
it's really hard. Like, that layer is so thin. But yeah, if you really like are laying in, I mean, that's one of the reasons why when you're sanding, like, don't put a ton of pressure down and don't tilt, like I still do this because I'm trying to get just that little spot, you know, of glue line or something like that. But, you know, it's when you really exaggerate that and you're like laying into a corner, not only will it burn all of your Velcro on your sander because you're applying heat. Yeah, that's fun because then you got to replace that whole sanding
head.
So
mostly with sanding burn through, don't.
Don't, yeah, just don't. Don't do it, and then you won't have a problem. Brilliant. Yeah, so really when it comes to sanding, don't put a ton of pressure down or focus on one spot for too long.
It's better to do many small layers.
Right, and then a lot of that stuff is going to come out, you know, later on, or it wasn't a problem to begin with, or, you know, in the case of trying to, like, match up seams between two panels of plywood. Don't ask me how I know this. Don't try to like over sand it to get it to match up, or if you do, just be okay with burning through that layer. It certainly is not a problem if you're building paint grade stuff. If you're doing like a cabinet carcass and you're gonna paint it anyway, as long as it's smooth, it doesn't matter
for sure.
But if it's something where you're trying to preserve that outer veneer, like, be very careful with that. There's not a lot of good ways to fix it. Other than trying to find some way to hide it. So you may end up replacing a piece for that. But for a little bit of burn through, sometimes you can kind of like touch it up a little bit or something like that, and it'll be okay. But, or I don't know, you could get really extreme and try to re-veneer it, but I wouldn't recommend that.
Yeah, that's a lot of work.
So. Yeah, mostly it's just avoid that mistake. You know, some things you can't patch. So avoid that mistake in the front by don't like bear down on your sander. It's not good for your sander and it's not good for the project. Like if your sandpaper is gunked up and it's just you need to replace it, replace the sandpaper. Like, it's disposable for a reason. And then if you're like leaning your Orbit sander to like get the, you know, push harder on the edge, you're also going to damage your sander and you're not doing it. Like, really, you should hold, you can, you know, you can hold the sander by its hose, essentially, like, off of it and not put any like, the sander weighs enough to put pressure down on whatever you're sanding type of thing, and go light. You know, if you're not getting enough removing of material, you probably have skipped grits and you're not helping yourself out that are there at all by skipping through stuff. So go slow. Don't put too much pressure on it. You know, get everything lined up ahead of time, like use dowels, biscuits, whatever you need if you're doing edge alignment. And then, but if you're doing paint grade, who cares? Go for it.
So covering screw holes doesn't seem like as much of a mistake per se, is just something that's part of many projects.
Yeah. If you're having to put screws and stuff, or even pocket hole screws, it could be kind of unsightly, and, you know, some people don't care. They'll leave that kind of stuff there. But if you're wanting to patch that stuff, or
depends on how pretty your screw is.
That's true. Yeah. If it's, if you got good looking hardware kind of thing, but this is specifically for like, if you're countersinking screws in and you want to make them disappear, again, you want to pay attention to, wood color and grain direction. This is where I use my dowel maker to great effect. I have a little dowel plate and I will actually take the wood that I'm using on that project because it's a perfect match for whatever I'm doing, and I will make my own dowels, and then I will drive those in. And no matter what you do in your wood shop, whether you're a hand tool or power tool or hybrid woodworker, you will love a flush cut saw. There are so many applications where you just need to nip off just a little bit. Now, pro tip, if you're using a flush cut saw, the teeth basically don't have a set. So, you know, if you think about a normal handsaw, the teeth are kind of staggered back and forth.
Yes.
Now, on a flush cut saw, they are not. They're in a straight line, but they can still kind of scratch up your surface. So what I do is I have, because they're cheap, a whole bunch of packs of playing cards. And I will break out a regular old playing card and put that down, put the flush cut saw on top of it, so it just has a little bit of a standoff, and that waxed card will move back and forth, keep my surface from being scarred up, and I can clip off dowels that I've already glued in to hide the screws, zip them off with that flush cut saw, and then you can finish the rest off with a really nice sharp chisel.
Brilliant.
And then, like, if you really want to go above and beyond, you're paying attention to grain color, grain direction. So when you're finally done with it and you do like the, you know, flush cut saw, a little bit of chisel work, a little bit of sanding, it's gone. Like you can't even tell that it's in there. And then
I can see some of the stuff on my breadboard and I have to hunt for others. But it's pretty. They're just little wood polka dots.
And the those
which
are
is fine.
Those are pocket holes. So those you're doing in at an angle and then trimming them off. And once again, like the flush cut saw, flush cut handsaw is the trick for that.
Also, they're pretty.
Yeah. You can get, they sell pocket hole plugs, I guess you would call them.
Probably.
But they're just like pine.
As long as you have a dowel maker, you can make it.
Custom. Yeah, you can purchase your own dowels too, and you can purchase them. Like if you're doing stuff in oak, buy oak dowels. I just like being able to make my own because I think that it matches better.
You're more likely to get an exact color and grain match.
Yes, I think so, and also the size can match better because you can kind of like as you're progressing through a dowel plate, you're making the dowel smaller and smaller and smaller. So you can like try it out as you go. And then I've had trouble with the plugs, which are, to describe them, they're essentially a dowel that's already been cut, but it's separate of the pocket hole. So it's got a really steep angle. It's like a wedge on one side of the dowel.
I've seen them.
Yeah, and it's like getting that orientated just right so it disappears is so difficult to do.
Yeah, it's fine if you want a button on top of something.
But if you just, you know, slather a dowel and glue and plug it in there, and then, you know, like wipe off the excess glue, wait a second, and then trim it off with a flush cut saw, then I think it looks way better. Like it just fits better. And then like the orientation is obviously perfect because you're cutting it flush off to begin with. Little chiseling, little sanding, it's gone. Same thing with just straight in countersunk screws. Same thing. Glue, plug it in there, let it dry, wipe off the excess glue, trim it off with the flush cuts handsaw and a playing card for a little bit of a standoff, chisel, sanding, it's done. You don't even have to wait for the glue to dry completely, just enough that it's kind of set, and then the rest of it you can move on with that. But there are plenty of things where you like screws are a good option, and you just want to hide them because it's not going to look good. Like I'm going to do that in the bar top.
Oh yeah.
But I want those obviously to disappear because I'm going to do, a finish coat over the top of those.
Definitely.
And, if you do ever have to get back to the screws to like disassemble something, there is a way to do that where you basically break the dowel, the little chunk of dowel, and then you can pull it out or you can drill it out and then remove the screw. So it's not a great fix because you'll get some tear out and stuff. But, if you absolutely have to, it doesn't mean that it's gone forever.
Speaking of tear out, the dreaded tear out.
My favorite.
Especially with pine.
Well, really with anything. Actually, plywood's probably the worst. Plywood, like trying to get a nice edge on plywood's a pain.
Plywood tears out if you look at it.
Yeah, pretty much. And it's because
I don't do anything with it.
Have you looked at my plywood?
I look at the tiny, right?
And it's just like, why is it all torn out?
I glanced at it as I walked by.
Yeah, plywood's notoriously bad, and it's just because of that really super thin layer on the outside. There's really nothing to support those fibers, and depending on how much glue they've actually got in the hopper at the factory when they're making the plywood, it may not be adhered that well to the rest of the layers. Okay, so on your power tools, tear out. So on the unsupported side, as the blade goes through a material, as the blade exits the material, it's going to grab fibers and rip them out of the surface, and you're going to get all these wonderful frayed splinters on one side or the other. The way you do away with that is finding ways to support said fibers during the cut. That's one half of the equation. The other half is making sure you have a clean and sharp blade. The dirtier the blade, the more it's prone to tear out and kick back. And the sharper the blade, the more it's going to sever fibers instead of beat them up like a baseball bat kind of thing. Like if you think about it, like if you're going to film that process with a high speed camera, and that also has something to do with feed rate too. If you're just like you know, jamming wood through a saw faster that it can cut, like you'll see a noticeable difference no matter what's going on with your blade in the wood. If you just slow down a bit, you'll notice that you'll get less tear out. It won't eliminate it, but you'll get a little bit less, right? Because you're giving the sharp, you know, the tip of that cutting blade is having more time to neatly sever those fibers instead of, you know, it biting off too much and then it's having to basically break it instead of slice it.
The same thing with blowout, splintered corners.
Blowout's kind of different. Blowout is kind of the end of the board. So you'll get that if you're, yeah, as you're going through something either on the table saw or on the router table or even with a hand plane. Once you get to the end, the very end fibers at the finishing part of the cut, the best example is with like a hand plane across something or across end grain.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that last bit of grain on the end of a board as you go across it will... the blade will just grab all of that and pull it away from all the rest of the fibers. Because, I mean, you really have to think about, like, with wood, you have to think about it like a whole bundle of sticks. Well, those last sticks are not supported by anything, so you're just going to grab them and rip them off.
Right.
So the way you get around this, the way you fix this, is you give support to those fibers. You either have a sacrificial board or you have a zero clearance plate. So you have the plate where the saw blade protrudes up from the table saw, or if you're using like a track saw or a circular saw, you're putting a foot on there that is has a gap in it that's no wider than the blade itself. So all the fibers that are left over are supported by that insert. You can get other ones, right? Like if you're tilting the blade, you have to have a wider throat in that plate. So you're not going to have that kind of support. And then when you get to the end of the cut, that end grain, that last bit is going to blow out. Blowout's particularly annoying because sometimes it's like that hangnail you get and when you pull on it, it just keeps going.
No!
Sorry.
No! Why would you do that?
She's like visibly cringing at that. I'm sorry. But I mean, that's a good analogy, right? Because that wood grain's running along the edge. So when you start pulling it off the back of you're essentially pulling it off the back of the end grain, it's going to keep going depending on how that grain goes. Yeah. So it's a pain. Now, usually it won't completely tear off. So you can squeeze some glue in there and get it in there and then put a clamp and get it all back on. The way you avoid that with end grain is you either put a sacrificial board up against the back of the board that you're cutting. So as you cut through, it's supported all the way through, so you won't get that blowout. And then if you're hand planing end grain, you go about halfway and then you start from the other side. So you're not going all the way over the end of the end grain. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So, you know, you're kind of coming at it from both sides into the middle. So okay. You never have to go over the edge and then grab a bunch of fibers and rip them off and you get that blowout.
So is that also related to splintered corners?
Splintered corners usually like happen at some other part in the process. Something gets hit and a corner gets splintered off or something like that. You get some damage in the very corner of a board and you're like, man... That's going to be my show corner. I really need that to look good. You know, you can't hide it type of thing. The way you fix that is you can plane it off. Well, either save the splinter if you can find it, right? And slather it in glue, put it back on, clamp it on, and then you can do some light sanding and hopefully that'll work that out. If you can't find the missing bit, what you can do is you can plane it. This is where like a nice block plane, even for a mostly power tool shop, comes in handy. You can plane it till, even if it's at an odd angle, just plane it until you have a flat plane over the broken corner. So get rid of all the ragged edges. Then you can actually use super glue to glue on, or wood glue, to glue on a scrap piece. Remember, grain color, grain direction, once again. And then you can use your flush cut saw to trim off, you know, the X side, the Y side, and the Z side reasonably close, and then sand the rest of it, and it will disappear.
Gotcha.
And you'll have a nice sharp corner again where that corner got knocked off. Right. And it's, you know, that'll happen because the grain's kind of running in that direction. You'll just hit it just right, and it just takes the whole thing off. And you're like, oh, my gosh. Or you had some blowout on it because it wasn't supported. And now you're like, oh, man, I don't know where that chunk went. It flew off somewhere, got sucked into the dust evacuator. It's gone forever.
All right. Something I'm not as familiar with it is the kerf. What happened?
The kerf.
Is that like a curse?
No, no, no. No, it's not the child that lived.
Oh.
No, the kerf.
Child that lived.
The curse? He had the curse on his forehead?
Oh, the boy that lived. Yes.
The boy that lived. Oh, see? I messed up there. I didn't get the reference right. All right. So the kerf is the bit of material that's removed when you cut it with a saw blade. So the kerf on a 1/8 inch wide blade is 1/8 of an inch. Where you'll get in trouble is if you forget to remember the kerf.
Measure.
Yeah, measuring.
That's why you measure like 5 times to cut once.
Well, and then you cut to the wrong side of the line.
Oh, no.
So, and then that's where you forget the kerf. Or worse yet, you're cutting like multiple boards.
That's when the swearing happens.
Well, you'll mark out like multiple cut lines, but then you forget that you're like taking off 1/8 inch every time you cut. And then your boards just get progressively shorter and shorter. And you're like, what? And you're trying to put stuff together and it's all wrong. And you're like, by just that much. And you're like, what is happening? Yeah, the kerf is literally what's removed by when the blade goes through the wood.
That is very important.
Yes, very important. And math is hard. but you can get different. You can get different kerfs, right? You can get super thin stuff. You know, if you have a handsaw, that's even thinner, which has some advantages. Or if you're using the bandsaw.
Know your blades.
Yeah, they all have different kerfs. But that's literally what... I mean, the biggest way around this is just when you're marking out your lines, what I'll do is I'll just mark an arrow on the side that's the waist side. Make your cut, then make your next line if you're, like, doing progressive cuts in the same board.
Okay.
That way... You know, you're measuring, you know, if you're measuring 18 inches, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you mark an arrow on the waist side, you cut it, that board should be exactly 18 inches. Then you can make your next one. You know, this one, I need to be 12 inches. Make your little X on the waist side. Make sure you set up your blade so it's only cutting through the waist side, you know, and then you should be all right.
Excellent. How does dirt make mistakes?
Oh, dirt? As far as like... Well, I think that's more related to finishing.
Okay. So cleanliness in the workplace.
Yeah. Don't put a fresh coat of lacquer on something and then continue woodworking in a shop where you don't have good dust extraction. Don't ask me how I know this.
Does it turn into a nice suede type top finish?
Yeah, you could say that.
Okay.
You could say that. Definitely has an interesting tactile texture to it. Yeah, that's not pleasant. Now, I mean, you're going to, for some things, you're going to...
Whereas if you're making tactile boards for children.
Yes. Yeah.
Brilliant.
This is rough and this is smooth. This is a mistake. This is not. So, if you're doing multiple coats, you're going to sand in between them anyway. But you just don't want to have something wet that's curing in a space where... And a lot of us have this go on, right? Where... You're in a space where you still have things to do, but you have something that's curing. So that just comes, and you don't have like a curing room that you can set it aside in. I have seen some cool things where you can do like painter's cloth, like the plastic drop cloth,
mm-hmm.
and they'll hang it like a shower curtain.
Okay.
And then, you know, that's reasonably sealed.
You have a little clean room?
Yeah, essentially, it's at least, you know, the dust and stuff is not going to get into it. If you do have a need to continue working, you know, and your workflow is such that you don't have time to wait for that to cure. But for most of us hobbyists, you can alleviate that by just managing your workflow so that when you're done with all the sanding and everything and you're ready to finish the project, you're kind of coming to a close in the day, and then you can do your finish coat. and make no more sawdust, right? Because otherwise you get this nice prickly surface that you have to sand out for, like, everybody loves sanding, right? So if you want more sanding, just make this mistake.
Yeah. No. Oxidation. What do you do with all of your rags? Especially with things like linseed oil and fun things like that. You just throw them in a bucket and forget about them, right?
Oh, yeah. That's a good way to lose your shop.
That's attached to your house.
Yes. So oily rags. I think most people know this, but boiled linseed oil.
It's always a good reminder so that you're not the one on the home video.
Yeah, exactly. Boiled linseed oil is the first one that comes to mind, but anything that has a very chemical odoriferous kind of thing going on.
I think I smell something burning, no?
Yeah. I mean, safest way is because as that material oxidizes, the oxidization process builds heat. And if it gets to its flash point, especially if it's something that is flammable already, it's a fun science project. Don't do that.
Do it with your children outside.
So I've only once ever actually seen this happen, and it was just kind of a pile of rags, and it hadn't actually caught fire, but it was smoking, and it was hot to the touch. So it was in the process of getting ready to go. So the way you do away with this is you just lay out everything flat, so there's nothing crinkled, because when it's all crinkled up, it's got room to build up heat as it oxidizes. So lay it out or drape it over something that's not flammable so that everything can evaporate from it and it's safe. So if you have like a muck sink or what have you, or if you can just lay it out on bare concrete away from anything that's flammable just in case. But typically if you lay it flat, it's not going to have any issues. If it's when you ball them up in a big pile or throw them in a can that you're going to have a flaming trash can sometime later that morning. That's a big safety one. So yeah, if you're using any kind of finish, and there'll be warning labels on there on how to deal with waste when you're dealing with that product. So just be careful and be safe with that stuff.
Interesting. Moisture and milling. So that's when it's not your fault.
What, milling mistakes?
Yeah.
No, it's all your fault.
I mean, always.
Gosh, especially now because there's been like weird supply chain stuff with lumber. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is super, super soaked. Like,
which is why the fresh fences fall apart.
Yes. Well, especially with fence boards, I think, because that stuff gets gone through a lot faster. You're not going to have, well, I don't know, maybe you can get kiln dried fence pickets or something like that. But you're going to pay for it for sure. You definitely have to lay that stuff out and let it dry so that whatever warping is going to happen happens. But even just like pine and some other things, other building materials, moisture is going to be an issue. So if it's over a certain limit, I'd recommend getting a moisture meter if you're skeptical about if your wood's dry enough to use or not. If you get yourself a moisture meter, a good moisture content range of about 6 to 8% is ideal. That will prevent any warpage, shrinking, cracking, bowing, cupping, anything that wood's going to do that's problematic. But also, if you are milling wood, you're going to be releasing a lot of internal pressures. So you're going to get just, even with dry wood, it's going to move. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in unpredictable ways, it just depends. So the big one to avoid if you can, I had a very long-term project that required milling and waiting and kind of chipping away at the project over a long period of time, which is problematic because then the wood moves. By the time you get to it, it isn't milled to the dimensions you thought it was, or it's done something. It's warped, it's twisted, it's cupped, it's bowed, whatever. And you can get away with it to a certain extent by clamping it into submission or, you know, fixing it into submission or something if it's a longer board. But the shorter the board gets, the harder it is going to be to get it into the shape that you want it to without it basically fighting you and eventually trying to pull itself back out of that position.
I feel like we're talking about my hair.
No, we're talking about my wood bench. Your hair is amazing. Don't worry. But yes.
No, that's all the things what? That it does.
Yeah, hair and moisture. They're the same thing.
Yes, hair and wood. What happens when you use the wrong tool for the job?
Well,
I mean, I do that all the time. That's what a majority of screwdrivers are not for. Don't.
Well, every tool is a hammer. We know this.
Don't just grab a screwdriver and use it for anything.
Well, there's creative solutions, and then there's
only
just...
Only when your husband isn't home and you can fix it before he gets home.
Oh my gosh. I have so many questions. All right. So, I mean, there's a certain amount of making creative solutions that's, you know, good. You know, sometimes we got to think outside the box to figure out something. But then there's a point when you have that little voice in the back of your head that's like, this is stupid. You're going to lose a finger.
Don't lose fingers.
Yeah. Listen to that voice. And if you're doing something that just feels unsafe and is just kind of not like, you're like, this is definitely going to end badly. And there's that little tickle in the back of your brain. Like, listen to that. Like, don't do it. Like, figure out a better way to do it. It's important to be safe in the shop. Certainly, there are some things. You know, the classic one is using the wrong screwdriver for the wrong screw. And you just end up stripping it out, and it's a nightmare. And then you're trying to figure out some of this way to get that screw back out and that kind of thing. Or you're just making an awful bird, sharp metal mess. And there's plenty of examples of that. Using the right tool for the right job is always a pleasure, and you just can't go too far outside the box for that kind of thing. I'm struggling to think of a good example on this one.
You're pretty good about using the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, you'll know. Yeah, I mean, it's always worth trying some things, but I think you'll know when you're using the wrong tool for the wrong for the
if it takes job. Way too long and
or too much effort or. You know, you're just struggling to make progress. That's definitely a thing.
Router and blade burn.
Yes.
Don't overdo your tools.
Yeah, don't overfeed them, but also the burning part is typically...
Don't set things on fire.
Don't set things on fire. Oh, gosh. This has a lot to do with how sharp the blades are and how clean they are. I got a cleaning little station thing. For cleaning my saw blades, and it works great. It's got like kind of a round scrunch pad, and you just kind of spin them around in it. Mm-hmm. It works really well. Take the time to get something that removes resin from your blades and clean them regularly, especially if you're using something that's very resinous, like pine, because it will gum up your bits and your blades. You'll get that kind of brown, resiny kind of buildup gummy stuff on the outside of your blade. That's what's causing a lot of the burning. Because that builds up friction and heats up the blade, which then makes
resin
it...
Resin does catch fire very well.
Yeah, it does. but all that is creating friction because now you're basically incrementally increasing the kerf of that blade, and that's making friction, which is then, if you pause, especially at any point we are cutting, it's going to burn the wood and then also dull blades. So keep them clean and keep them sharp. Clean is cool and sharp is good. Clean is cool as in... The blade is cool.
Also just cool.
It's just cool.
What is nibbling?
So if you're trying to sneak up on getting a piece of wood just the right size, this is what I call nibbling, which is where if you're working on the table saw specifically is where I kind of use this the most. I'll push the piece of wood up against the flat part of the blade, not the teeth, when it's off.
Again, and then no losing finger.
This is typically with a crosscut sled. And then you pull the piece, holding it in place, back, and then turn the saw on and run it forward. And it will basically only take off the difference between the flat part of the blade and the part where the teeth, the carbide teeth, protrude from the flat part of the blade, which is like probably a few thousandths of an inch. So if you're really just trying to sneak up on it because you can take off too much really quickly. And you can do this with some other, you could probably do it with a miter saw if it's a quality one doing the same thing. I've had some good results with that where you butt it up against the flat of the blade, keep the piece of wood there in place, lift up the blade, turn on, cut, and it just takes off just a little bit. Nice. You can keep doing that, you know, and that's if you're just like just barely there and you're trying to get a very, very careful, perfect cut. And I call it nibbling.
It's fun.
Because that's what it kind of feels like.
Mm-hmm. Very effective. What did you learn from some of your most challenging things? Like, I know the workbench took almost a year.
Yeah, the better part of a year. There's plenty of mistakes in it. I mean, I ran into the milling issue where the stuff moved on me over time. I ran into issues with, you can hear the dog moaning in the background.
Our little tea kettle.
Oh, it's terrible.
She's fine. She has all of the cushions and the snacks.
Yeah, definitely plenty of snacks. It's still not enough for our precious princess. What else? I've made some mistakes and cuts and I had to patch them. And, you know, with some skillful router work and a sharp pair of chisels and the nibbling technique to make a perfect little patch that fit in just so. And then trimming that off with flush cut saw, playing card, and chisel, then sanding. And that was one of the ones I'm like, come see if you can see this. And you're like, I don't know what you're talking about. And I'm like, yes, kind of thing. So there's plenty of little things like that because I had to do a lot of precision engineering to get that, just all the right pockets and everything for the benchcraft vices and stuff to fit in just right. So yeah, there's plenty of mistakes on that, and on the end, I tried to do, the houndstooth dovetails, and they did not work out.
Oh, they're going to be, I was heartbroken.
Yeah, I was heartbroken too. I basically had to cut them off to make it all fit together. So I had to go back to the drawing board with those because they weren't perfectly square.
But, you know, for your first major project and not actually having a shop, it was like we basically spent the entire year of days off in your dad's shop.
Yep, back and forth.
Doing that. So it still turned out very well.
What else? I made mistakes with boxes, especially larger boxes, because it's harder to do. Like small boxes, you can make the thing complete and then cut the top off so it matches perfectly.
That relates to what you have on the bench right now, doesn't it?
Yes. So I have a treasure chest on my bench that I'm making out of some scrap woods that I needed to use up. And again, I torture myself by making the box lid separate of the box, and then the two of them don't match up. It's kind of something you have to deal with larger boxes because it's hard to then wrangle a large box. Like we're talking like a blanket chest over a table saw to cut off the lid. There are ways to do it, maybe with a track saw. But it's difficult doing them separately. But of course, I like to torture myself by doing those. So I've kind of learned from that. But smaller boxes are easier because you can just run them across a table saw, you know, just not quite all the way through and then finish it off with a handsaw and to cut the lid off and then trim it with a block plane or something like that.
Miters.
Difficult. Oh gosh, I think miters are everybody's bane because they're just hard to do.
I can do it with a sheet, but I don't try with woodworking.
No, miters for like picture frames or like for long miters for doing the corners of a large box like the chest that I did.
Right.
Because I wanted to torture myself and do a miter the whole way along.
I mean, it was beautiful.
It worked out. It did finally come together, but...
The client loved it.
Yeah, that is true. Those are some things that have been challenging. Like, miters are always challenging because getting them perfect, like, angle. Even though you think, it's just a 45-degree angle. It's like, wood moves. The saw blades aren't 100% accurate. You know, it takes a lot of, you know, setting up and making sure that your table saw or whatever, or your track saw or whatever you're using is perfect. And it's aligned correctly so that you're making a truly 45 cut. All right. What else do we have?
How does that just summarize into a whole?
Well, you don't learn from your successes. You learn from your mistakes. So just getting after projects.
The more it hurts, the more you learn.
Pain retains. Yes, definitely. And, you know, the wood, we're using wood. We're using a natural product. And I think just like any other pseudo art form, I mean, I don't think woodworking is necessarily an art. It certainly looks like art after you're done with it.
It is. You have to work with it and work with it.
Yes. And the medium always has something to say in the project. And I think sometimes that's cool because it kind of guides you in a certain way. And maybe you'll change some of your designs to kind of work with it. And then obviously making mistakes and learning better ways to do things through those. Like you'll remember to do this and not that and things like that. So embrace your mistakes and your mishaps. Like be safe. Don't make the big mistakes. Don't pile up a bunch of oily rags in the corner. Don't saw the small bit, you know, between the fence and the blade so it shoots back and pegs you in the chest, you know, with kickback.
Don't run into your fence.
Yeah, don't run into your fence. So, you know, those mistakes are going to happen. Hopefully, they're not big stuff. It's little aesthetic stuff, you know, or you measure something wrong and you have to use some more board, you know, you'll learn from those mistakes. So embrace them,
take
be safe,
time.
You know, but definitely they're going to happen. So just get used to it. But yeah, no, they're definitely something that's just a natural part of it, of learning and growing and woodworking and getting into it, jumping in and doing the thing and learning and seeing the stuff. You know, it's just like picking up a new species of wood. It's going to react differently on the saw. It's mm-hmm. going to react differently in your hand with a chisel. And you're going to just have to do it to learn. That's how we learn.
Indeed.
Okay, so time for our last segment. 10 simple beginner projects. You're going to start making mistakes. Safe mistakes in the wood shop with these projects. These are really good ones. This is just a short 10 beginner projects list that I have curated that are, in my opinion, some really good projects for you to start off with that mm-hmm. I have done most of these and actually I've done all of these and that...
Number one was your first.
It was, yeah. So a mallet, just a regular wooden mallet will teach you some good skills. I personally laminated some hardwoods together. So there we got some glue up stuff and then shaped it. And did a through tenon to make the mallet. So it's a knockdown mallet, which is really cool. And it's still serving me to this day in the shop. And the next one?
The shooting board.
A shooting board is something that you use with a hand plane. So it's something that you'll lay your plane on its side and put a board in the shooting board on the shooting board, and it has a stop on it, and basically can run the plane across it, and it basically is a 90 degree jig that you can run your hand plane over to make sure that your board end is perfectly square to the side. That's in reference on the shooting board.
This is why I don't use random pieces of wood in the shop, because you never know if they have a purpose or not.
Yeah, well, if it's several things glued together, yeah. So you can buy fancy ones, but you can definitely make one a lot easier, and you can even do a miter shooting board at a 45. Ooh. So you can do that for trimming, you know, perfect miters if you're into hand tools. The next one's a crosscut sled. you can certainly, this is another one you could purchase, but you can also make your own simple crosscut sled. There's lots of cool designs out there on how to do this, but basically, if you're not going ripping boards on your table saw and you need to trim them with a high degree of precision, a crosscut sled is a great accessory for your table saw, no matter what kind of table saw you have. The next one.
Push sticks.
Yes, for safety, push sticks.
Safety is important.
Make a piece of wood, push the wood you're cutting across your table saw so that it gets cut instead of you.
I do still like that you have all of your fingers.
Yes, and I don't have a stop saw yet, but
that one's still spendy.
Yeah, it is kind of spendy.
We haven't come up with the money for that one yet.
Even then, get push sticks and make your own push sticks. Because then you won't be having to spend $100 every time you activate your stuff.
And it's still going to touch your finger. You're still going to have to go to the ER.
No, no. Small Nick. No problem.
I still saw that hot dog and yeah, no.
I don't think you'd have to go to the ER for that. Super glue and it'll be fine.
Right.
Picture frames. Picture frames are notoriously difficult to make because of the precision. The miters need to be also cutting the rabbets in the back of the picture frame so that you can actually have a space to put said glass, picture, backer, that kind of thing.
We've seen all of the offcuts in the dollar store.
Offcuts in the dollar store.
Or the off picture frames.
Oh, yes, yes. Terrible, terrible miters.
The ones that don't go to the professional things, go to the dollar store.
They're definitely tricky. And this is something that is a great gift to give because typically picture frames are quite expensive. And I think they're almost too expensive, overly expensive in some cases. And you can make some really cool.
Some of them, yes.
You can make some really cool picture frames for not very expensive, if or not a great cost to you, especially if you get good at it.
Yeah.
You can make some compound frames if you're really, really driven.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, this one.
Hmm.
The drawer organizer.
It'd be a really easy project. I've done things similar to it where you are cutting a lot of dados. This is similar to your spice rack because a lot of that's like a lot of other thin boards fitting in to all these little dados in this kind of complex way. But you can custom fit it to your drawer if you do it this way.
I'm looking forward to this project.
Just as an example. Like I've done lots of things that are very similar to it, not exactly the drawer organizer, but I've done plenty of things that are like it. And measuring, definitely a big thing, talking about forgetting your kerf, right? This is not where you want to do that. Planter box, easy. This is the one time I have actually deigned to use pallet wood.
Hey, I like that planter box.
And it was kind of cool because they were kind of rounded pieces. So it did make an actual kind of cool planter box. It was kind of sort of a live edge kind of thing going on there. It was definitely some of the sapwood, the outside wood, just under the bark and stuff like that. Our dog just came in here and crop dusted us.
Love her.
Oh, that's rank. So planter boxes are fun and they're easy. There's lots of different types, but they're kind of, you know, I would say
it's an easy project that you can customize to exactly what you want.
And no one expects it to be perfect.
No. You're going to put water and dirt all over it.
And eventually it's going to biodegrade and come apart. And so, you know. but they're very cool, and you can make them in all kind of varieties. You can line them if you want them to last longer. Sandpaper storage. We all use sandpaper, no matter what you do, or you should. And a sandpaper storage box is super useful so that no matter what brand it is, whether it's rounds or squares or whatever you're using, you can have them in a place that's easy to find and is organized per grit. And then what that also gives you is kind of a visual cue when you're getting low on a particular grit. You can go restock. The next one I'll say is a cordless drill storage. I made a little hanger for mine that's got some kind of oval-shaped cuts where I can just hang up my cordless drills. It's also got some spaces for some spare batteries. Very, very nice to have because then they're not living on a surface and taking up a lot of surface space on your bench and kind of having no place to live. Hanging them up is definitely good. And it teaches you, you know, how to make a square box and
very useful.
How to, you know, make some dados or however you want to construct it. It is very simple and it can teach you a lot of good skills as far as that goes. And the last one would be for me a simple workbench, just making not necessarily a full on split top Ribot, you know, French style workbench, but just a basic table, something that you can beat up, something that's simple to make. You could go further and make like a English style workbench that has a place where you can attach a vise and some other stuff. But it's something that's going to serve you well into the future because it's, you know, you're putting it together, it's your first project, it's, you know, you're making a simple table, which can springboard you into making other things like tables or making a fancier workbench later.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my top 10 beginner projects for you if you want to get started. And there are definitely things that for a beginner woodworker will serve you later with the skills and the usefulness of the finished project that you will get out of those. All right, I think that's going to do it for episode 6. Thank you so much for listening. You can find us on all those social media platforms that we have out there. The tweets, the posts.
We don't tweet.
No, we don't tweet. But we do the Facebook. We do the Instagram. Sometimes I got to get some more pictures on there. We have some of those good things. You can find us on our website, which is bosunscallwoodworking.com. You can also find us if you'd like to support the show on Patreon at bosunscall@patreon.com, or you can sign up to be a member. We will mention you on if you decide to sign up as a member, and we will really, really, really appreciate you as a supporter of the show, because it does have some costs associated with it, so you can keep us continuing on with this thing and supporting some improvements to the show. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next time.